Washington, D.C. every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. for an hour-long Generation Progress Takeover.
Check us out at genprogress.org or on Twitter at genprogress.
And I do my thing like this because it's who I am. If you expect me to give you an apology.
Hello, this is Anisha Singh. I am here with my co-host,
Charlotte Hancock.
And we're here with the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. Thank you all for tuning in. You know, so there's a lot going on. There's still a shutdown. It seems like every day the president has a different reason to keep this going and a different excuse,
temper tantrum, a different national security crisis that has been manufactured, maybe.
Absolutely. And while you know, some parts of it we can maybe laugh a little bit, there are real people impacted. There are, you know, individuals who are not getting paid, who are not able to pay their bills right now, who are worried about whether or not they're going to make their mortgage, be able to provide for their families. And, you know, he's really towing the line right now on these folks' lives.
You know, I also saw this morning that that Nancy Pelosi is asking Trump not to have the State of the Union.
Absolutely. Everyone should read that letter. It is pretty amazing. Just telling him, you know, you need to submit it in writing. And that's it. If they're going to have this shutdown, we're not going to have Secret Service and the rest of these folks having to
come to work without pay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know how they can expect that.
I know. So today, though, we're going to be talking a little bit more about some of what the 116th Congress is doing, in particular H.R. 8, which is the background check bill that Speaker Pelosi and others have been talking about and promoting. What's so interesting about this bill is that it is bipartisan. It is pretty narrow, and I know there's some backlash on how narrow it is, but it is narrow so that we can hopefully get it passed, because it is bipartisan. We know that background checks are really popular with the public, and so we're here to talk a little bit about that. And we have two guests here today. During the first half, we are going to have Dante Berry, the co-founder and executive director of Million Hoodies Movement for Justice. And then the second half, we're going to have someone from the Center for American Progress talking about our efforts here, Chelsea Parsons, who's the vice president for the Gun Violence Prevention Movement. To kick things off, Dante, welcome to the studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Million Hoodies. You know, what was it born out of, and what is it that you all do?
Mm-hmm. So like many young Black people, after the death, the murder of Trayvon Martin, we were outraged. And we were born out of the tragic shooting, gun violence that was shot Trayvon Martin. And we provided the initial response to the murder. It became national. It didn't become national news until mid-March. Trayvon was killed on February 26, 2012, and it took about a full month before it became national, brought any bit of national attention. And so we were the organization that helped to generate that global support. Since then, a lot of that has been very organic, right? We, one of our co-founders, Daniel Marie, was the person that kind of moved into motion at that moment. Mm-hmm. I got brought in about 2013, right around the time of the acquittal. And Daniel was like, hey, we need to turn this into something sustainable. We have so many people that are outraged by this moment, that this moment is not just an isolated incident, and that we're seeing young Black and brown people across the country get shot down and killed, and that there's an intersection between gun violence and the criminalization of our communities as well, right? We look at mm-hmm. the policing, we look at mass incarceration. There's a distinction between how they are connected. And so today, we are a human rights membership-based chapter organization. We work with students around the country in high schools and college campuses who are organizing to build safer communities in their and on their campuses and their local communities. And we're really building a movement to end gun violence and to reimagine safety and justice for all communities. And the way that we do that is looking through the intersection of criminal gun violence, criminal justice and policing, and poverty.
And so what are some of those intersections when you're talking about intersecting gun violence prevention with criminal justice reform, poverty, and a lot of other issues? You know, in the progressive movement, we're always challenging ourselves, especially here at Generation Progress, you know, how are we being intersectional with this work? So what does that look like for you guys? What are some of those priorities?
Absolutely. I'll start with like a personal story. Like I grew up in a small town in New Jersey called Mount Holly. I was raised by a single parent in a single parent household with my mother raising me, working multiple jobs to put food on the table for me and my younger brother. And no one in my family has ever gone to college. And I was the first to go to college, go away to college and graduate and so forth. And I had a lot of insecurities dealing with the fact that I was poor. I didn't like to talk about being poor. I just like had a lot of shame and guilt into that. And I think a lot of, in the country today, I think a lot of folks kind of grow up in some type of understanding about, we want to be able to live prosperous in our communities, but aren't necessarily given the opportunity to do so. And so for me, I always saw the issue of gun violence in relationship to how I was born, like struggling in a low income family. And the way that I came to organizing was because of, I saw the disconnect between how the young people in my high school were in remedial courses that looked like me. While I was in honors and AP courses, there's very few black people in honors and AP courses, but there was a lot of people that were in remedial or like lower rigorous courses. Mm-hmm. And there was tons of gang violence in our community, in our school. And so I pieced that together, right? And I pieced that like how our community was situated, that people were experiencing poverty, people were experiencing violence, right? When there's not enough resources in our community, there's not enough opportunity in our community. And so a lot of the fights around violence is about competition about, let me get those shoes or whatever, because there's not enough resources, I'm doing in air quotes, in our communities to be able to live prosperously. Mm-hmm. And so for us in Million Hoodies, I think a lot of the way that we think about a lot of this work, particularly around gun violence, is actually it's about a disinvestment in communities. I think the issue of gun violence and a lot of like DC-centric policy debates have always focused a lot around the guns, which are important, but gun violence is a multilateral like problem and actually requires multilateral like solutions. And one part of the solution is dealing with the issue of the access of guns, but the other part of the issue is actually understanding the systemic roots to how violence actually like manifest, and that's also about a disinvestment in communities. And so I take that, that's how I come a little bit into the gun violence work. I also come in into, because I've experienced policing in very particular ways, and I've had family members who've been killed by, not by police, but by a gun. And so it's very personal, but I think a lot of the piece around poverty and community disinvestment gets missed in a lot of conversations about gun violence.
Yeah, I mean, I was speaking on a gun violence prevention panel this weekend, and that was something that I felt was really important to bring up, right? The way we talk about this issue is so important when we're thinking about different communities that are impacted by gun violence. So, for example, one of the narratives you hear a lot is, I don't feel safe in my school anymore because of the gun violence that is so prevalent in schools. I don't feel safe going to school. But then there are communities in this country where going to school is the safest place for them,
exactly.
Right? It's the actual community where it's more prevalent. And so how are we making sure as a movement we're being unified in our messaging and not leaving out certain communities or certain people, especially communities of color, from that narrative? So that's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought that up.
I mean, even to your point real quickly, like I think when you even deal, even if we got rid of all guns, like the problems that my community won't still feel safe because we're still dealing with the fact that we don't have resources. Mm-hmm. So even if like someone is, their school is their sanctuary because it's not safe in their home and it's not safe wherever, like and they go to school, and then they're also not safe there. Where is where is safety?
Absolutely. Right. And that's a great point. And so when we get back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit more with Dante about some legislative solutions. You know, what can we see happening with this current Congress? What can we see happening on the local state level when it comes to gun violence prevention? Mm-hmm. So stick around and we'll be back.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, 888-6-LESLIE.
Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Charlotte Hancock, and I'm here with
Anisha Singh.
Great. Thanks so much, Anisha. So before the break, we were talking to our in-studio guest today. We have Dante Berry, the co-founder and executive director of the Million Hoodies Movement for Justice. And before the break, we were talking about why it's so important to have the intersection of gun violence prevention, criminal justice reform, police brutality, and why it's important that we talk about, you know, poverty, why it's important that we talk about these issues all together. While it's important to talk about these issues altogether, it seems really like gun violence prevention has been having a moment over the past year. You know, we can't ignore the movements that the media has been like shining a spotlight on, and we have to try to bring along every piece of the movement as we talk about this. But last year was a pivotal year in the gun violence prevention movement between Parkland, Thousand Oaks, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and other places, and our country witnessed the truly devastating power that an unregulated gun industry mm-hmm. can have. And so many communities in America. And looking forward, where do you see the gun violence prevention movement going? And are you hopeful for legislative solutions at the local or federal level?
Oh, this is an interesting question. you know, I feel like the gun violence prevention movement has been focused on background checks for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And I think regardless of whatever happens in this session, like, I think there's always going to be a question is what's next, mm-hmm. right? Because you can only go so far. And I also believe that that's also a half solution mm-hmm. of the problem. And so, I think the thing that, right, we all understand the value of what it means to be safe in our communities, and I think that across all identities and types of all backgrounds, we all want to be safe.
Right.
I think the question about how do we actually build policy based around a set of values are actually really important, and I think the tradition of policies around gun violence has been so focused around crime, not necessarily about ending crime or reducing crime or preventing crime, but about like, let's actually just get the lock these criminals up and like like mm-hmm. stop getting all these guns in the street, and not actually providing any bit of policy or solutions that are really grounded into, all right, let's build a public safety framework mm-hmm. that allows for communities to feel like they can be lifted up instead of being criminalized or like tossed out or caged or locked away. And I think like I think that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done within some gun violence prevention spaces that actually brings up some of these tensions. Because I really think that, like, at the federal level, I think just framing everything around background checks, it's going to be a standstill. And we're not going to move on anything else meaningful. And I think really it has to come from a public safety perspective that is not so much focus on recriminalization. From a state and local level, I think that there's a lot of work that can be done. I think that we're like funding gun violence prevention research, I think funding actual programs like ceasefire programs, programs that have been underutilized and are effective at reducing and preventing gun violence, I think is actually the places that we need to be focusing more attention to. I think just solely focusing on policy is not gonna move forward a lot of the work that is happening in communities across the country. And the last thing I'll say is that I think outside of policy, I think that the movement as a whole has a huge gap around actually organizing and engaging communities. Like, I think we do a good job of telling what communities should be advocating for, but I don't think we do a good job collectively of actually supporting mm-hmm. the communities and mm-hmm. helping decide what the safety actually looks like for mm-hmm. them. And so I think if anything's a shift, I think that's actually where we need to be going.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those comprehensive solutions? You know, you can say like it's not just background checks. Like mm-hmm. what are some of the other things that we need to be thinking about when we're thinking about other solutions? You know, it may not happen this time around, but it's mm-hmm. stuff we can always do better, and we can maybe, you know, give it a go for the next round.
Absolutely. So there's many, many, many perspectives on this, and I've been definitely the big advocate around police accountability, police reform, and policing, and really mm-hmm. looking at, like, when we deal with, particularly with communities of color, even poor communities, that the first form of engagement with the criminal justice system is really with the police. And so just by having some form of, like, power for communities that allows for some bit of accountability, like a citizens review board that has subpoena power, for example, is one form that also allows for communities to feel safer outside of not just the gun. I think that when we look at the militarization of police, looking at the 1033 program, there's a federal surplus of military-grade weapons that are actually provided to police department, local police departments, and college campus police departments and high schools that have a proliferation of guns, and so and have, like, tanks and all these different things. And I think that's one way of reducing the access of guns. That's not just in the framework of what the community has, but also in the framework of what the police has as well. And I think for most developed countries across the world, the issue of gun violence isn't really a big issue, but it is a big issue for us. And I think that's both within our communities and also with the institutions that are supposed to be mm-hmm. That are supposed to actually create, like, safety, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, again, like, I think a lot of this is really going back into reframing how we think about safety.
Yeah. And I think we've just got another minute left here. So I just want to make sure that we get to this before we have to say goodbye to you, Dante. Mm-hmm. If people are interested in hearing a little bit more about the movement that you're working on, that you're spearheading here, really, how can they find you? Where can they find you on Twitter? What's mm-hmm. your website?
Absolutely. People can go visit millionhoodies.net find out a little bit more about our history, where we work on, get involved. We have chapters around the country that work with students. You can visit us on Twitter at Million Hoodies and on Instagram at Million Hoodies for Justice. Find me, Dante Barry. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram, all those things. And I think the ways that folks can get involved, folks can donate. We need resources to keep doing the work that we're doing to build safer communities for all. And folks can also join to start a chapter or join an existing chapter. And those are three ways that folks can get involved.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. We appreciate you talking with us, Dante.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, we're going to have Chelsea Parsons from the Center for American Progress talking about the background checks bill.
Leslie Marshall. Real people. Real life. Real talk. 888-6-LESLIE.
The Leslie Marshall Show. My name again, Anisha Singh.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
And so we're back, and now we have another guest, and this is a good friend from the Gun Violence Prevention Team here at the Center for American Progress, Chelsea Parsons. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, before the break, we were talking to Dante from Million Hoodies about the intersectionality with gun violence prevention and a lot of other issues that are super important to communities, especially communities of color. And one of the things we talked about was H.R. 8, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, that is the bill that is currently on the floor. That is the bill that has been proposed by the new Congress, and that's the bill that we need to be paying attention to, recognizing that it might just be the first step of many steps to really curbing gun violence in this country. And so that's why, you know, we'd love to talk to you and hear from you. You know, what is this bill about? What is H.R. 8, and what are the different pieces that it encompasses?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on to talk about it. And I think it's really important to acknowledge at the outset that this is not the bill that is going to fix gun violence in this country. And, you know, this is very much a first step piece of legislation. And it will address one of the most harmful and glaring gaps in our current federal gun laws. And so the reason we want to start here is because we should fix that and then build on it. In order to address some of the other problems. So H.R. 8 is the bipartisan background checks bill of 2019. And what it does is it would finally fix the gap in the law that allows upwards of a fifth of all gun sales in this country to happen without a background check. So under the current federal law, if you are a licensed gun dealer, you are required to conduct a background check before every sale. But under current federal law, if you are not a licensed gun dealer, if you're just a private individual, you are free to sell a gun to whomever you choose without having to do a background check and without having to ask any questions, keep any paperwork, really do any due diligence to make sure the person you're selling that gun to is legally authorized to possess a gun. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what H.R. 8 does, is it would require a background check for all gun sales, regardless of whether you're buying a gun at a gun store or you're buying a gun from your neighbor.
That's super important, because I think this loophole, you know, all the loopholes that we've seen in the past have caused a lot of debate in this country. And I would love to hear more from you. You know, what is the opposition saying about this, right? When we're talking about these loopholes, what are they pushing back with?
Yeah, so we're starting to hear, you know, the usual greatest hits from the NRA and from others in the gun lobby. There's a pretty predictable series of arguments that are made about any bill that seeks to strengthen gun laws in this country. So a lot of these talking points are not even unique to a background checks bill. So, you know, they will say it violates the Second Amendment. That is a lie. I mean, just to be blunt about it. The Supreme Court in the Heller decision, which was authored by Justice Scalia, specifically held that the Second Amendment is not an unlimited right and that it's subject to reasonable restrictions in order to protect public safety. So, and the courts since Heller have held repeatedly that laws that have been enacted at the state level, like background checks, like an assault weapons ban, are well within constitutional limits. So that is a complete non-starter of an argument, but it is one that you hear over and over again from the NRA. There's also an argument being made by the NRA that requiring background checks for all gun sales would have the impact of criminalizing, you know, a father giving his son a gun and you know, or a hunting buddy sharing a gun with another hunting buddy on a trip. The bill was actually written with a few narrow exemptions in it to address exactly those kinds of transactions. So in the bill, a father can give us gun to his son without having to go do a background check. There is an exception in there for kind of a limited loan of a gun to your hunting buddy if you're out on a hunting trip. So in fact, the bill was written with those kinds of arguments from the NRA in mind to try to alleviate the concern from a number of gun owners that some of the gun culture they are used to wouldn't be impacted too much by this law.
And I think that's what's so important on this too. This is a bipartisan bill, and it was intentionally drafted so that there wouldn't be as much pushback and there could be a hope of it being passed. And so what do you think the chances of that, you know, happening are with the Senate and this president and everything else? You know, what are the chances we have here?
Yeah, I think it's a really hopeful time on this issue right now in this particular Congress. This bill is not just bipartisan because there's one Republican co-sponsor. We actually have five, which in this Congress I think is a pretty big deal. The leadership in the House and Speaker Pelosi has said that this bill is a priority, and then the House will bring it to the floor and will pass it in the first quarter of this year. So that's really exciting. We haven't had the House take action on a gun bill in recent memory. And so I think, yeah, so I think it's, we're finally getting to this place of like, no more moments of silence. You know, we actually have one of the houses of Congress ready to take action. You know, the Senate is a different beast.
Yep.
but I think what we're going to see is the pressure that's going to be put on the Senate once the House passes this bill is going to be pretty substantial. And I think that you have a number of senators who are going to be running for re-election in 2020, who are in states where there's a lot of support for this kind of bill. And so, you know, I think that we're going to push really hard on the Senate. I think that, unfortunately, we know there will be another horrific mass shooting sometime. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that'll happen. And so those are the incidents that tend to drive a lot of action on this issue. And so, you know, we'll see what happens and what, you know, Mitch McConnell's response is the next time there's a shooting on the scale of Parkland or of Las Vegas. You know, how long can he continue to refuse to do anything about this
issue? Thoughts and prayers.
So we're talking a lot about this legislation and about keeping this out of the hands of people who are not licensed to necessarily like own guns and that sort of thing. What sorts of problems is this meant to prevent? I don't want to like look back too hard at the tragedies that our country has seen, but is there something in particular that sparked this sort of legislation? Like what can we say like this would prevent another something from happening? Why is this so important?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And often the debate that we have around gun control and new gun laws is really focused on, you know, what could have prevented X most recent tragedy.
Sure.
And part of the limitation in that frame is that, you know, each of these incidents is different and there's not always a really clear answer mm-hmm. as to how we could have prevented a particular person from getting a gun. You know, one of the areas that I think this background checks bill would really have a significant impact is in making sure that domestic abusers and stalkers don't continue to have easy access to guns. You know, under current federal law, if you are subject to a domestic violence restraining order, if you've been convicted of a domestic violence offense, you're prohibited from having a gun. But without a universal background checks requirement, it's really easy for somebody who is prohibited for those reasons to be able to go buy a gun anyway, either at a gun show or online through one of these private sales. And there have been a number of instances where a prohibited domestic abuser has been able to buy a gun anyway through this kind of transaction mm-hmm. and then killed his ex-wife. You know, this happened a few years ago in Wisconsin at a day spa where you had an ex-husband, you buy a gun from an online transaction and he went and murdered his ex-wife. So I think that that's the kind of area where you really will have a big impact in making sure that people who are clearly posing a risk to somebody else won't be able to as easily get a gun.
So we've talked a little bit about H.R. 8. What's the next step, right? So let's say we get this passed. Knock on wood, all the things, all the prayers. Then what's next? What are there other pieces of legislation that Congress could put forward to move in this movement?
Yeah, so there's lots of choices because our gun laws are so ridiculous
and
terrible.
So little in place.
That's correct. So there's lots of choices of things that we could do. Some of the things that are top priorities for the Center for American Progress are an assault weapons and high-capacity magazine ban. So we had one in place for 10 years. It was allowed to expire. We know that these kinds of weapons enhance the death count mm-hmm. when you have a shooting like this. We know that these are weapons that allow somebody with very little technical expertise to be able to fire a lot of rounds really quickly. And so, you know, we're hoping that this Congress will take a really serious look at what a new version of an assault weapons ban could look like. I mentioned domestic violence. There remain gaps in the federal law that allow domestic abusers who commit their abuse in the context of a dating relationship as opposed to a marital relationship to be able to still have guns. And so that's a loophole mm-hmm. that we need to close, you know, particularly because we know more and more couples are choosing to not get married or to not get married as early as in previous generations. And so it's a really important update to the law. There are a lot of really strong community-based programs that work to intervene in cycles of violence and help really address some of the root causes of violence that lead to high rates of gun deaths in a lot of neighborhoods. And so those programs are really dependent on federal funding. And so we're also really encouraging this Congress to increase its investment in grant funding to help support a lot of those kinds of programs as well, so that it's not just purely looking at the laws and what can we do to strengthen the laws, but also looking at how can we help support other kinds of programs that are really having an impact in making communities safer. So those are just a few of the things that we're hoping that this Congress will take on.
And on the flip side, what can states do? What can people on the local level do? What kind of bills are we hoping to see there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of overlap between what we're looking for at the federal level and at the state level as well. One of the kinds of bills that have picked up a lot of traction at the state level are what we call extreme risk protection order laws. They're sometimes called red flag laws. What this kind of legislation would do is create almost the equivalent of a domestic violence restraining order, where if you have a family member or if law enforcement becomes aware that a person in the community owns guns and is in a period of crisis where they are posing a risk of harm to themselves or to others, you can petition a court to temporarily remove their guns from them during that crisis period. This is the kind of law that potentially could have been useful in the Thousand Oaks shooting, potentially could have been useful in Parkland. You know, you have a number of cases where a person was on the radar of law enforcement or kind of was on the radar of people in the community as maybe being in some kind of crisis period, but there was no mechanism to be able to remove their guns from them. So these kinds of laws have really started to pick up steam at the state level and is something that I think we'll see a lot more states considering this year.
So where do folks need to apply pressure? You know, this we've talked about how important this is. What are the next steps for people on the ground? Are there things that activists should be thinking about? Are there committees? Are there states? Are there particular senators? You know, what are the next steps to make sure that this becomes law?
Yeah, I think right now it's really important for everybody to reach out to your member of Congress and make sure that they have signed on to co-sponsor the background checks bill and plan to vote for it. We need to have this bill pass with a really high margin to really demonstrate the strength of it for applying pressure on the Senate. I think the same can be said on the Senate side. Reach out to your senators and just continue to make the point that gun violence prevention is a priority issue for voters. It's an issue that we're not going to kind of take quietly anymore. You know, we know from a lot of the exit polling that this was an issue that was really important to voters, particularly to young voters. And this Congress, you know, we're going to ask a lot of both the House and of the Senate. So I think just continuing to put pressure on your elected representatives to make sure that they are aware that this is an issue that's important to constituents is hugely important.
And what is the gun violence prevention team here at the Center for American Progress prioritizing? What do you guys have planned for 2019?
So one of the things that I'm really looking forward to doing later this year is taking a little bit of a pivot away from, you know, kind of individuals who cause harm with firearms and really taking a strong look at the gun industry itself. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we know is that for a variety of reasons, including the laws, including the fact that the ATF is purposefully underfunded, the gun industry is largely unregulated. You know, most gun dealers go a decade without ever being inspected to make sure they're complying with the law. I think gun manufacturers are probably inspected even less frequently. And so you have this industry that its sole purpose is just selling weapons designed to kill other people that has very little oversight at all from the federal government. And so I'm hoping to kind of start to really bang that drum quite a bit, you know, as we're looking at strengthening our laws, as we're looking at, you know, other ways to help reduce gun violence in the community, also making sure that the industry responsible for flooding our communities with all these guns is being held to account and you know, is at least starting to realize that they're not going to be able to continue operating, you know, unfettered anymore.
And with the last couple of minutes we have here, let's shift over to the NRA real quick. So you're nodding, you're smiling, you know
yes,
what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So what are those pressure points there too? How do we hold the NRA accountable? Because we have been, you know, we've been hearing the rhetoric for quite some time about how we need to do that, but there haven't been too many solutions for how we do that. I know some of these bills and legislation that are coming up are going to help do that. But with the last minute we have here, you know, what does that look like?
Yeah, one of the things that I think was really remarkable about the response after Parkland is the fact that you started to see mainstream businesses start to break ties with the NRA. So the NRA has for a long time had a really robust corporate partnership program where they have discounts and all kinds of things offered
credit
through different
cards.
And car rentals and all of these things. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to kind of drive a wedge between mainstream corporate America and the NRA for a long time. And as a combination of the way that they reacted to the Parkland students and the kind of increasingly extreme rhetoric that their spokespeople use, and the seemingly endless string of mass shootings, all of a sudden, corporate America kind of got it. And so you started to see companies really breaking that relationship. So I think we'll see more of that to come.
Absolutely. Well, where can folks find you?
I'm on Twitter at Chelsea C. Parsons and also at Cap Gun Violence, I think is our team handle. Oh, no.
Well, thank you so much, Chelsea, for being on the show. And thank you for talking us through HR 8 and all the other things that we need to be thinking about when we're talking about gun violence prevention in this country. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back after this break.
Welcome back to the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Charlotte Hancock, and here we have Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News, and she's going to give us a little bit of an update on what's going on. Ellen, hi, how are you?
Hi. Well, first of all, the economic reverberations of the shutdown are really just beginning. What we know is that so far it's 1.1%, but that's expected to go up a lot. And also, you have a lot of government contractors. For instance, Delta Airlines says they're going to lose $25 million. They're going to lose it because they're not having government people fly. I also know somebody who is married to an ICE employee, and they're expected to show up for work, and they're not getting paid.
So, I mean, that's bonkers. I think that I can't believe that the impacts that real people are having every day and it's still going on. So tell me a little bit more about yesterday's Senate vote on Russia.
So what we know is that they voted 57-42 to begin debating this resolution, but then it didn't pass today. And so this is to stop the president from gaining favorable, he's gaining favor for three companies, basically, that are very big in Russia. And they tried to stop it because many of the Democrats were against it, but didn't succeed.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that? I can't believe that this is, you know, this is all that we're seeing on Russia right now.
Well, it's because basically they don't want to go against the president, and the president wants to favor Russia. Now, why? I don't understand it. I mean, frankly, these guys have been messing around. They deserve to not have special sanctions pulled on them, and that's what's going on. They're going to have sanctions will be pulled, and therefore there aren't going to be any sanctions on these three guys and three companies.
Especially given the amount of indictments that we've seen, the amount of investigations that are happening, the amount of individuals that have been questioned, I mean, this is something that we really need to be paying attention to.
Well, for sure. And, you know, you have a guy who's looking to be the attorney general, and he's not. He even said yesterday that he believes that Russia tried to interfere with the election and that we have to get the bottom of it. So we don't know whether they did or not, but we know that they tried, and he believes that we tried, and he's the Trump nominee for attorney general.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the latest, Ellen. It was great talking to you. And that's it for the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. We will see you next week.
follow Leslie on Twitter. Just go to www.twitter.com/Leslie Marshall. We'll be sure to share your tweet.